Welcome to Parents' Perspective. I'm Linda Perlis.
And I'm Sandy Burt. What is happening with our children's backpacks? Are they getting larger, heavier, more unwieldy? Or are the children carrying them getting younger? Or both? Since 80% of the population has back problems at some point in their lives, we as parents have a special interest in preventing our children from being a part of these statistics.
Our guests today will give us an overview of children's muscular and skeletal development and some guidelines to back us up in this important area. Dr. Neil Barkin is an orthopedic surgeon and father of two college students. He has the added advantage of being married to a pediatrician. Welcome, Dr. Barkin.
Hello.
Heather McDonald is a physical therapist with the Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. We're glad to have you here, Heather.
Thank you. Hi.
Heather, when a child carries a backpack or other heavy object, is there a proper way to distribute the weight of the load?
Well, as uncool as it may seem, the proper way to carry a backpack is with the two straps over shoulders, and most kids these days don't do that because it just doesn't look as cool as slinging a backpack over one shoulder. Carrying weight on one side really causes a lot of strain and stress on your back, and it's really not the best way to do it.
How do we encourage them to do it right?
Start by example, carrying your loads on both sides. Moms carry heavy pocketbooks on one shoulder, and they tend to have the same problem, so you could start by carrying your loads on both shoulders. You could also just talk to them about their posture and try discussing their posture with them and see if you can come up with a plan or some kind of behavior modification program to get them to carry their backpack in a better way.
Now, what about other heavy objects? Just straight on?
Best way to carry any load is as close as possible to the center of you. The center of your weight is somewhere in your tummy. If you're carrying anything heavy, it should be close to that center so your body, all your muscles can appropriately adjust to the weight, whether that's on your front or your back. So the backpack, the heavy load goes right in the middle of your back. If you're carrying a heavy load, let's say a pile of books, you want to hug them in as close as possible to avoid putting more strain on your back.
Okay.
Dr. Barkin, could you give us briefly some background so we understand a little bit about children's muscular and skeletal development?
Children are smaller than adults.
Good start.
As a start. The primary difference between children and adults is simply that there's more cartilage in a child than an adult, and they're still growing, so there are growth zones in their bones that are a bit fragile. And that is the largest difference between a child and an adult, that there are these growth zones, that they are somewhat susceptible to injury, and that the youngsters have not gained their full strength yet because their muscles are still relatively small.
Are there problems that parents should watch for in terms of the skeletal growth?
Not in particular. I think that the nice thing about the human body is it sends signals when something's wrong. If a youngster is complaining of pain, or if you see that there's an area that's particularly swollen, then that's certainly a good indication that something needs to be checked. The other thing that parents should look for is symmetry. I mean, children should grow equally on the right and the left side. So some children, for instance, do develop leg length discrepancies or deformities as they grow, and that's usually fairly easy to pick up. Primarily in the summertime when the youngster's in a bathing suit or in wearing less clothing. But usually these are not subtle clues.
So in other words, leg length discrepancy, you could tell like if one hip looks like it's higher than the other, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Usually it's asymmetry. One hip might be askew, one shoulder might be higher than another. Sometime a tip-off is in purchasing clothing, you find that dresses or pants need to be tailored because just by taking it off the shelf and putting it on, you find that one pant leg is too long or too short, or one arm length, one sleeve is too long or too short. That would be a tip-off that maybe there's something asymmetrical happening.
Mm-hmm. Of course, sometimes growth is asymmetrical, right?
Growth is most often a little bit asymmetrical, but that's in millimeters or you know, small amounts. I'm talking about when it becomes more extensive than that to the point where it actually represents a deformity.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, we always hear about scoliosis and kids. What about parents picking that up?
Scoliosis, as you know, is screened for in most school systems now at least two levels in the school program. And by and large, the best screening test is to stand behind the youngster, have the youngster bend at the waist, look at the contour of the back, and check to see if there's a flat configuration to the back rather than, for instance, a prominence on one side or the other. If there's a prominence, that indicates that there's a bit of a rib hump, and that could represent the beginning of scoliosis. It's probably the simplest way for a layperson to check for scoliosis.
Is that something parents should do at some particular time?
I think it's probably worthwhile to do it in a somewhat subtle manner. I wouldn't draw the youngster's attention to it. I wouldn't become obsessed with it. Scoliosis is a relatively uncommon condition. And you can see, as I said, probably if you just pay attention once during the summer at the beach to see if the youngster looks straight, it's probably all that's necessary. As I said, the school will screen at certain points.
But this is public school systems.
Public school systems, I don't know. Private school probably requires it too, but I'm not certain.
Oftentimes, private schools will have someone come in. For instance, we have a therapist at our facility who volunteers her time and does scoliosis screenings in the schools. And she's picked up a few that way.
Does she contact the schools?
I think they asked her to do it. I'm not sure how that got set up.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, Dr. Barkin, you mentioned growth zones. Where are some growth zones, or what are you referring to?
Well, just about every bone has at least one growth zone. It's a transverse zone. It's usually at the end of the bone. If you get an x-ray of the bone, you'll see an area that's thin and is obviously of a different density than the rest of the bone. And these growth zones are largely cartilage, and that's where the length of the bone is extended from. Each one of these growth zones closes at a certain time in our lives. Each one has its own schedule of when it closes. And once it's closed, then it's no longer susceptible to injury. Until it's closed, though, it can be susceptible to injury. For instance, if a youngster is hit, say, playing football, or if a youngster falls off a bicycle, it's not uncommon to see a fracture through that growth zone.
Is Osgood-Schlatter's disease related to the growth zones, or is that a completely separate thing?
Osgood-Schlatter's is a condition on the upper tibia. It's where a large tendon attaches into the upper tibia. There is a cartilaginous growth zone at that location. It is susceptible to the repeated stress of that tendon attaching.
For the rest of our listeners who don't know what the tibia is.
Tibia is the big bone of the leg below the knee. It's a relatively trivial condition. It's annoying. It causes pain. It also is a self-limited condition that tends to resolve once growth is completed. Until growth has finished, it's usually relatively easy to control simply by restricting activity level and using some heat and ice, and there are various, occasionally an anti-inflammatory medication is helpful, but it's not a terribly serious condition, and it does resolve.
Thank you. Heather, what physical activities are age-related for health or safety reasons? Could you give some examples?
Going along with Dr. Barkin's talk about the growth plate, contact sports are particularly dangerous for children whose growth plates have not completed yet for the fact that they're more fragile.
What ages are we dealing with?
Growth plates, I believe, close around 16 for females, 18 for males. Is that accurate?
Well, there are charts in our books, and every growth plate is a different time when you expect it to close, and it's very variable. Some stay open into the late teens and early 20s, and some close much earlier than that in the early teens. But by and large, growth in general stops at about that time. In girls around 16 mm-hmm. or so, and boys about 17 or 18.
So you can see that contact sports are dangerous for anyone, particularly for children who haven't finished growing yet, mm-hmm. not just for that reason.
Yeah. Even though we're an auditory medium, I can just see red flags going up everywhere that this is being listened to. So what do parents need to know in terms of things like football and wrestling and stuff like that?
Well, I think the proper equipment, first of all, the proper shoes, proper helmets, padding, all the safety equipment is vital to the safety of any kind of contact sport, whether it's ice hockey, football, rollerblading, if you're doing the high-impact type or anything like that. You need to have responsible adults who can monitor the activities and make sure that they are age-appropriate. You don't want the little guys tackled by the big guys or things like that.
So well, in terms of, for example, football, then, is there any kind of rule parents should know as a rule of thumb before X age they really shouldn't have their kids playing that kind of sport?
Well, there are Little League football associations, so I personally wouldn't let my, if I had children, I wouldn't personally let them play until they were high school age, when they were big enough, strong enough that their muscles and their coordination was great enough to overcome a greater stress. A smaller child just doesn't have the stamina or the strength to overcome a stress like that. So I wouldn't recommend contact sports under high school sports.
In some areas they play football in, and it's screened by, every league is screened by age and weight and height. You know, they do it. And then when you get to high school, there's none of that. They play, the tall, skinny kid is playing with the great big refrigerator size kid, you know.
I think that's a decision the three people need to be involved in making. That's the child, how badly, how important this is to them that they participate in the football team, how the parents feel about their child participating, and if the coach feels that the child is able to keep up, which is a controversial issue.
Anybody who participates in a sport like football should assume that at some time they'll be injured and could very seriously be injured. It's the nature of the game. I mean, if you look at professional football, one of the major factors in who wins and who loses is the number of people out at any time injured. So it's, you know, it always surprises me that people come into the office sometimes year after year after year after year astounded that the youngster has been injured and he's playing football. I can understand that if you were injured playing chess or piano.
Surprise.
But not football. I mean, you have to have a certain attitude about these sports when you embark upon a career in any type of a sport. Some sports are just very prolific in producing injuries, and that's part of the sport, and you have to accept that as one of the consequences, one of the occupational hazards of being in the sport.
I think kids think that it's not going to happen to me. So I think it's what
parents.
You're saying is up to the parents to be more aware. Kids always think, well, it's not going to be my problem. Yeah, people get injured in football, but not me. I'm invincible.
I'm fine, right?
We haven't talked about, for example, weightlifting, toe dancing. When are these okay, or are they?
Weightlifting is another controversial sport. Weightlifting, when used as a training technique for another sport, to improve function in another sport, can be very appropriate for younger children when the appropriate supervision, the appropriate weight, and the appropriate activities are used. Weightlifting as a sport, the powerlifting, the guys who just want to get huge, that is very risky if the weightlifter doesn't know what they're doing, they're not balancing their activities, if they're not stretching the muscles that they work, can be very dangerous, especially for children who are still growing.
Yeah, key word is moderation. I mean, if anything is done in moderation, it's probably relatively safe, but it's when it's done to an extreme that it becomes dangerous.
There must be guidelines for young people in terms of learning weightlifting, for example. Parents can go in any sports equipment store and buy a weight bench and the weights that go with it, and there you've got a kid with nobody acting as a spotter, nobody explaining that he has to do other physical exercise. You know, to go with it, we kind of want to get the warning out to parents.
Again, I think a nice thing about the human machine is that it does tell you if you're doing something wrong more often than not. And, you know, I think that's what you have to listen to. If you buy your child a weight bench and you buy him weights and he lies down the first day and he lifts his weights and comes up the next morning and he can't walk or he aches all over, he can't lift his arm, means he's overdone it and he's injured something. And the first approach should be to modify the amount of work that he's doing on that weight bench. He's obviously exceeded his tolerance. Every kid is going to be different. And so it's very hard to produce guidelines that say every kid who's 12 and a half years old should lift only up to a certain amount of pounds with a military press, because the big kids, it's not going to be appropriate for, and the little kids, it's going to be inappropriate for as well. So I think you have to just listen to your body more often than not. As a general rule, lifting lighter weights with more repetitions is probably safer than using heavy weights with few repetitions.
Danger signals. That's what you're saying. Watch for pain.
Right.
Are there other signals that parents should watch for that maybe the kid isn't aware of?
Swelling is a good one. Limp in the lower extremities. In the little kids who can't express very well, if they often will see a youngster stop using an extremity. For instance, will stop using an arm. A parent will bring a child in and say that refuses to feed himself or comb his hair or lift anything with that arm. And that's before they can communicate very well. And that's a clue. That's something that we have to evaluate and work up. In the lower extremities, a youngster will just stop walking.
Oh, my gosh.
And that can be a worrisome signal, too, that needs to be worked up. So.
One of my sons used to get a dislocated elbow at the very slightest thing. He's outgrown that now. He injures ankles. But.
Yeah, that's called a nursemaid's elbow. It's not entirely a dislocated elbow. It's they're basically one bone in the elbow just slips out slightly from where it belongs. And in the process of rotating the forearm, it usually pops right back in.
Mm-hmm.
But and in fact, more often than not, the person who treats that condition is the X-ray technician.
Because
when you order the X-ray technician has to adjust the elbow in two different positions to get the picture. It's usually in the process of doing that that it pops back where it belongs.
Does this have to do with growth? Because I have one son who had this until he was about 2 or 3, and the doctor said, finally, I'm going to teach you how to pop it back in.
Did you learn?
Well,
I never learned.
Sometimes it has to do with the way the child is carried. In other words, I've seen a lot of people on the street walk with their children, sort of drag them along with the arm, pulling on the arm when you get to a curb. In other words, if you want the kid up and quick, you yank in the arm. And that can often do it.
We had a brother who used to yank on the arm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
Yeah, a yank in the arm, that's what causes it.
Okay. Heather, what are some physical activities that can strengthen a child's body?
Well, when you're talking about younger children, general everyday kid activities, jumping around, running, walking, climbing, those all strengthen and build endurance in general. When you're talking about specific strengthening activities, sports-specific as a rehab program for an injury, bike riding is excellent for the legs. Swimming is a great one for arms and legs. Many household chores, actually, sorry, kids, can actually be included. Raking the lawn, if it's done correctly, is great for your arms and your back. Gardening is great for your back when you're not leaning over and straining yourself.
How about taking out the trash? Good idea.
Taking out the trash depends on if, you know, we're talking about carrying heavy loads again, so we need to be very careful with that.
Good luck.
I was hoping you would include cleaning your room. We had a whole list here. Okay.
How can parents recognize a break or fracture?
Fracture's not terribly subtle. First of all, there's usually a history of an injury. I mean, people usually don't fracture spontaneously unless they've got some terrible disease that's weakened their bones. So that's the first clue, that they were tackled on a football field or hit on a soccer field. Secondly, there is usually significant swelling at the site. Third, there's pain at the site. And if the fracture is displaced, in other words, if the bone is completely broken and it's apart, the person won't be able to use that extremity. If it's a leg, they won't be able to put weight on it. If it's an arm, they won't be able to move it. If it's non-displaced, in other words, if it's fairly stable, if the bone is broken but it's being held together by the remaining bone, well, let's say the integrity of the bone is still intact to an extent, very often the person can use the extremity, and sometimes that's surprising when 2 or 3 or 4 days later they come into a doctor's office and get an X-ray and find out they've got a fracture, even though they've been using it for a couple days.
My pediatrician, I had one son who had broken, I have 3 sons, so we have had all kinds of injuries. One used to have broken fingers periodically.
Right.
And the pediatrician used to say, wait till the next day. He said, put ice on it, but if he wanted to see if he could use it or not. It's not a dangerous thing to do that?
No, it's not inappropriate.
I mean, because we would go very often.
Because the vast majority of impacts don't cause a break. The vast majority of impacts just cause a contusion or a sprain. And time will tell. I mean, if in a day or two it's much, much better, then it's not a broken bone. If in a couple of days it persists, then it could well be a broken bone and should be X-rayed.
Yeah, a lot of those.
We all, I think, go through this business about trying to figure out what the difference is between sprains and strains. Can you help us out?
It's entirely anatomical. It has to do with the structure you're talking about. A strain is by and large a muscle, and a sprain is a ligament. Mm-hmm. Now, a ligament is what attaches one bone to another bone. So if you anterior cruciate ligament, for instance, in the knee, can be sprained if it's, or a medial collateral ligament, which is a ligament on the side of the knee, can be sprained. But if you're bending over and you're lifting something and you feel back pain, you've probably injured a muscle, and that's a strain. So it's entirely related to the structure that's injured.
Okay. Now, when somebody's got a broken bone, they usually end up in some sort of cast.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if it's a sprain or a strain?
It depends on which muscle is injured or which ligament is injured. When I was in training in the 70s, we tended to be very aggressive with casting ligament injuries as well. More recent research has shown that sometimes if you protect very briefly and then get the structure moving, that it heals even stronger. So I think in this day and age, there's less of a tendency to immobilize people for prolonged periods of time. There's more of a tendency to immobilize briefly, get the person over the period of discomfort, and then to try to rehabilitate as quickly as possible.
In terms of what parents should know about everyday first aid for some of these things, what kinds of things should parents be able to do or know to do?
Well, confronted with an acute injury, the first thing to do is generally to apply ice and to elevate. Then, depending upon how uncomfortable a person is, there's usually a little bit of a leisurely period in which to observe. If the individual is not getting better very promptly, then it needs to be evaluated. It needs x-rays. It needs to be looked at. If it's resolving fairly readily, then more often than not, it doesn't need an entire medical evaluation.
Is there anything where you do heat first?
Probably something, but I can't think of it right now.
It's all right.
Occasionally a muscle spasm is treated better with heat, sometimes with ice, sometimes with heat. But sometimes when you get a real big knot in your back or a Charlie horse, sometimes heat will release that.
In general, the concept is the ice reduces swelling in an acute injury.
Mm-hmm.
Heat increases the blood supply to an area and can actually increase swelling.
Heather, what is physical therapy? We're going to need to close soon, but we want to make sure we cover this.
Well, that's a difficult question to answer in 10 words or less, but physical therapy is a branch of the allied health fields, and what we specialize in is returning an individual back to their optimal functioning, whether it's in work, sport-related activities, or for kids, play is their job. And we do that through strengthening, stretching, aerobic conditioning, wound care, balance training, developmental training, all sorts of things. Anything we can do to bring that person back to their optimal level of functioning.
It sounds like you do it to them, but I have a feeling you have them do the work.
We try to make it as active as possible, and parents are very important too, especially with the younger children. It's really their job at home to make sure that these exercises or these treatments are carried through with, because children aren't going to do it on their own.
Okay. What kinds of things should parents be aware that they need to do with children who are having physical therapy?
Attending the session is the most important thing, because education is a big part of what we do. We want the parents to be aware of what to do, how to do it safely, how often to do it, and then to carry through at home, whether that means exercising with your kids or doing it for them or setting up a sticker chart or some kind of program to have them do it on their own.
Some kind of motivation.
Right. Yeah. A lot of
stickers work well.
Physical therapy, by the way, is the single most common method of treatment that I, as an orthopedist, prescribe.
Really?
That's interesting.
By far.
That's interesting.
So that's pretty
we're lucky to
know about it.
People like Heather around to do it.
Very important.
We are grateful to our guests, Dr. Neil Barkin and Heather McDonald, for their instructive and enjoyable comments. It's been a pleasure. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad we could share Parents' Perspective.
If you would like to send suggestions, comments, or questions to Parents' Perspective, please email us at parentspr@aol.com or contact us, care of this station. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.